Welcome back, 2021 and series 3 of The Events That Made Me. I'm Liz Taylor, International Events Planner and MD of the Liz Taylor Consultancy. I am obsessed with the events that made some of the most successful people that I know. And this season has a bit of a theme. We've got arts, culture, music, and a couple of extras thrown in on International Women's Day and World Book Day. But for now, I start with the man himself, Mr. Gary Neville. Today's guest is the only person that argues with me and is allowed to win. But then winning is in his blood. At 19, he joined the most famous football club in the world and played right back until he retired in 2011. Since then, he has evolved as a respected entrepreneur with a hand in many lucrative projects. In the meantime, he still owes me £120.96 from his wedding, which I organised in 2007. Welcome, Gary Neville.
How have you kept record of that?
I keep record of everything. And I think it was the bar bill. I think it was one of the cost of nine. Yeah, I think one of them, I think you owe me that from the bar bill, but we'll discuss that after. This is not about what you owe me.
I seem to remember your bill was nearer to 120 grand than 120 quid.
Well, if it was, you got kid, you got off cheap. Listen, this is a serious interview here. It can't have been a breeze growing up in the Neville household. Mum Jill played netball in local leagues. Tracy leading in netball. Her twin Phil having enjoyed his own football success. I knew your dad well. I'd organised various charity events for him and I responded to the brusque northerner that was considered intimidating. And maybe that was because we were cut from the same cloth. But he was a talented cricketer. So with all that competition in the home, what influence did he have over you as you grew up?
I'm just trying to get over the fact that you're calling someone else intimidating.
I told you at the very beginning, this was not an opportunity for you to have a pop at me.
No,
this is serious. Your dad was a big part of your life.
He was a big part of my life. Definitely the biggest part of my life in terms of obviously in the early years, taking us everywhere, pushing us into sport, influencing us, making sure that every time we played, he commented, he kept us grounded, told us when we played badly, told us when we played well, loved us. Cared for us, adored us, and put everything into us, along with my mum, obviously, as well. Both of them just dedicated their whole lives to their children. And they were helped enormously as well by the grandparents, my mum's mum and dad, who brought us up as well.
Did you want to go into sport, or did he want you to go into sport?
I think he wanted us to go into sport. He'd been a young player at Bolton Wanderers, I think, from the age of like 15 to 17, 18, and I think he got... I don't know if it was glandular fever or something like that that really hampered him. And then obviously he went into cricket. But he loved sport. He used to go and watch United every week with his dad. And the one thing that I would say influenced me most out of my childhood, the thing I remember most was going to United on match days over Barton Bridge, travelling over the bridge and thinking we're nearly there. Because every journey to kid in them on a motorway feels like hours away. Even though we were going from sort of Bury to Old Trafford, it was only half an hour, 40 minutes. But I knew we were there when we were going over that bridge. I knew we were sort of coming off and we were nearly off the motorway. And then we used to go for pie and chips at Marina's Grill at the top of the road, which is still there now. And that to me was definitely the best part of my childhood, thinking about going to United with my dad. And then my brother started coming as well, obviously, eventually.
Did you ever imagine that you'd be playing for the club?
You imagine it in terms of your dream, you think about it. I went at first at the age of 4 or 5, and to me it was like the most magic place in the world. It was like, I couldn't believe the vastness of it, the pitch, the players, the atmosphere, everything was just, it was off the scale. It was just, I can't really put into words what Manchester United made me feel like as a kid.
You must have been really thrilled then when City turned you down. Because, you know, it was a choice that you didn't have to make, really,
no,
wasn't it?
No, it didn't. And I always remember my dad used to pick me up when we scored, because obviously you can imagine all the, you know, the people in the stand, mainly blokes at that time, to be fair, would stand up. And I was like down here, a 5-year-old. And he literally had to pick me up when we scored. And I always remember it being like the best part of the week. And if we lost, I was devastated. It was a bit rough and moody at times. I remember against West Ham and other teams sometimes, it'd be a bit big fight on the forecourt outside the K stand. But all of those things just are the things that I remember with my dad. I always remember my mum saying one day, my mum's really placid and just allowed us to go everywhere, but they had a massive row in the morning, one morning. We were living on Ainsworth Road in Bury, and I remember my mum saying, there's no way you're going to the match today. I think my mum hadn't been well or something. And literally, no word of a lie, we snuck out about 12:30 and went into the car and just went.
Does she know now? Because if she doesn't, can I tell her?
And I just things like that stick in my mind of always doing anything to go to the match.
I think it's brilliant. I think the memories are what make you. So in 1996, you and Phil were the first brothers since 1877 to play for a winning side in an FA Cup final. Was there pressure for you to perform? Just tell me about that, because that must have been amazing for your dad.
No, I mean, it was unbelievable even before that when we were in the youth team. But when we got into the first team together and we were both playing, I mean, my dad went to every single match, home and away, and in Europe. He had the best... I mean, he died in 2015. Yeah, he died 4 years after I'd finished playing football. And I would say he had the best 15, 20 years that he could have ever imagined in his life, because literally his whole week was planned around either my sister playing netball and you go and watch me or Phil playing football for United or Everton towards the end. And his whole week was built around that. And it was his dream. Obviously, he'd taken us to United as kids. We were both playing for United in cup finals. We were playing for England in brilliant teams under a brilliant manager, winning all the time. To be honest, when you go through it, not just him, but all the other, you know, Butty's dad, Bex's dad and mum, they travelled everywhere to watch us, and they had the most amazing time, and it was like a family, really. The sort of spirit in the club was unbelievable.
It's quite amazing when you look back now, you know, you refer to them as Butty's dad and Bex's dad, but we're talking about boys that have made serious, serious careers and beyond from the football. And I just think you were very fortunate to actually be involved with that class of 92. I mean, they were, you know...
We were fortunate in many ways, because Sir Alex obviously was at the club who brought us through. We had six of us there together. We won everything. We were best mates. We were in rooms, we were in each other's rooms every single... You know, we stayed away in hotels 3 nights a week. But we just literally eat together, go out after together. We'd do everything together. And that wasn't just us six, it was the rest of the lads as well.
You're quite famous, really, aren't you? Maybe I've underestimated this. Maybe I should have had a little bit more. I would have put a suit on, had I known.
Oh, Bex's mate, Liz, you know.
I know, but you've never got me in there, you bastard. He's had a million parties and he's never used me. I've tried everything, and well, I will want it. And listen, you talk about Sir Alex Ferguson because he's referred to you as the best English right-back of your generation. And your career spanned 20 years on the pitch. So... just before we move on, just share some of those best moments with us. You know, was there one moment that changed your life? What games? Just two or three, because to the listener out there who are football fans, which will be the only reason they're listening to you, because there's no, why would anyone else listen to Gary Neville? Just give me a couple of those moments.
I think the big moment for me was, because when I went to 16, to United at 16, I wasn't a confident, authoritative, self-assured individual. I was a young kid basically thinking, you know, I was excited, but I was also anxious and I was also nervous about what was going to happen. And Eric Harrison was our youth team coach. And after about 3 months of being at the club, he used to call you in for a one-on-one meeting at the end of each month, almost like a review. And he said to me, "You surprised me." He said, "You've got a chance. You can play for Manchester United's first team." He said, "But you're going to have to listen to me. You have to work hard and do everything that I say." And that was the moment that I always feel like was the sort of turning point, because you're there, but there's hundreds of kids there. There's hundreds of players there. It feels like you're just one of so many. You know, we know the fallout rate and the dropout rate. We know that only one every two or three years makes it into the first team.
Yeah, but you're forget that. You are, as an individual, very determined.
I know, but I wasn't the person I am now, or the person that I became over a period of years. I wasn't at 16.
I wish I'd known you then.
No, I was a lot nicer then.
Oh yeah,
no, but I was. But you know something? The exposure to Sir Alex, to Eric, to Nobby Styles, and people say that, you know, you can't build character, you can't learn character, you can't teach determination. You absolutely can. And you just got to basically see it to be it. And I just saw determination in Roy Keane, Paul Ince, Eric Harrison, Sir Alex Ferguson. I saw people around me who were animals, absolute animals. They worked on a football pitch in the gym. Everything was like 110%. They would literally die for every single pass, every tackle, every header. And when you see that, you've got the level that you need to step to and go to. And that's where I was influenced by all of those people around me. And I became that person that I am today through those influences from 16 to 20. We all did, all of us young lads. We didn't go in there. You know, think about David Beckham or Paul Scholes. Scholes, he was an introvert who ate pies and had a pint before a game at 16 to 18. Bex was somebody who, to be fair, was an unbelievably talented football player, brilliant striker of a ball, great energy, but he wasn't tough. You know, he was somebody who liked being with his parents. He liked, you know, he moved away from home to come to United. We all became the individuals we became over the learnings that we had along alongside the people that we had. That's why the influence of others, the mentors that you have. If you see someone above you that's your, whether it's your parent, your teacher, your boss, that's bad, you're going to follow that. And that's why I think that when someone, like a young player came into the team, say at 17, 18, and they had issues with their discipline, I never used to judge them and think, I used to think, well, what's happened for them to be like that? We were all different. We'd all had different upbringings, different parents, come from different areas. You know, footballers come from mainly the most deprived areas in the country ordinarily because they're hungry as hell. They're desperate. They're desperate to play football. You've got to be desperate to play football. So this idea that I think you could grow up in wealth and become a football player is very rare because you just won't have the eye of the tiger. You won't have that hunger, that horribleness, that determination that you need to have, that self...
I think what's very...
selfishness.
I think where I envy you is that you are basically, you've got two lives. So because football started at such a young age and you retired at a young age, you've now got all the skills and you've got everything that you've absorbed from that and all the strengths and the weaknesses to move in onto another stage in your life. And I think that's, for me, you know, as an observer, is really exciting. And I wish that I'd had that opportunity, but I couldn't play football. So, let me
finish, because it's important, this, in terms of how I am now. Eric Harrison made me the foreman at 17 in my second year. The foreman the job of the foreman was to organise the other 13 apprentices in my year to do all the jobs. So he trusted me. He made me captain.
But he must have seen the potential in you.
I think he saw a bit of myself in him because I was determined. I was a defender. I did speak on the pitch and organise people because I could see the game. I felt like I could see the game on the pitch. But he made me foreman, he made me captain. And from that, I grew into somebody who then felt as though they could communicate to others about what they could do, what they should do, how we should go about it on the pitch, off the pitch. And my organisational skills built from that.
Equally now, I know that you, anything that you see in somebody that has potential, you actually jump on. And I think that's probably come from that. He saw that potential in you.
Yeah.
And sometimes people come along and you look at them and in business, you think, you know what? She's got something there. He's got something there. And he saw that potential in you.
Yeah, he did. And obviously he made me the foreman, but it was these were big. You talk about which are big moments. They're big moments.
Well, that was so that was an event that changed you.
Yeah, it's definitely an event that changed me because you then got to manage other people in a small way. We had to clean the showers, clean the boots, make sure the kit was taken in, the laundry was taken over to Old Trafford. We did all the jobs around the training ground. That's what the apprentices did. There were 14 in the second year. There were 12 in the first year. So there's 25, us 13 in my year. And all the jobs had to be done. And when the jobs were done, I had to go upstairs, knock on Eric's office and say, right, Eric, the jobs are done. The gym was cleaned. The floors were clean. The change rooms were clean. The showers, the baths, everything. And I would go around and check every single job before they were done. And then go and knock on his door. And he would come down, he would check that all the jobs were done. And he'd say, right, you can go. And this was probably about 4:30 every day. We used to be at 8:30 and leave at 4:30, 5:00.
It's not comparable, but it is comparable because I left school and went to Marks and Spencer's to train in retail. And it's a 2-year management training scheme. And you have to do every job. You have to go in with a warehouseman. You have to clean the floors. You have to go and unload the food at 4 a.m. And once you've known once you can do every job in that store, then you can move on to a management training scheme. And it's a similar thing. You can't ask somebody to do something unless you've done the job yourself.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I mean, that's a principle of being in a football team. You don't ask anybody to do anything that you're not going to do. You don't. The idea of the boss.
Do you miss it, Gary? Do you miss football?
I don't miss the football at all. I don't miss the football bit of it at all. I miss sometimes being with the lads, but I get that sometimes out of it. But I missed the being in the change room with the lads, and literally the laughs were unbelievable. It's just
I dread to think. Right, now let's just move on from here. Let's move on. That is a perfect moment for us to move on from football.
A bit different than Marks and Spencer's in the staff room, I would imagine.
Gary Neville has spent his life scoring goals. He is very goal-driven. I want to talk goals with you in more depth in the bonus air extension episode that's in your podcast feed right now. Now, listen, moving on from football, which has been widely accredited by many TV appearances and interviews, I did realise that this was not your first interview. I want to talk about Gary Neville, the brand.
The brand?
Yeah. Now, I'm very into brand. You are very into brand. You've got the Relentless brand. You've got stocks. You've got hotel football. That is all brand. Brand is king.
I feel like Tom Ford sat here.
You don't look like him, love. And no, listener, is he dressed like him?
I don't dress like him either.
In 2014, you set to buy Salford City with a class of 92. And from there, it's just gone bloody mental. You walked into the Corinthia Hotel restaurant, you asked for a table, and the next thing, you walk out with the chef, who then...
It's he, by the way.
What?
It's a he, by the way. Yeah. Did it sound right, that, Liz, then?
Let's keep them guessing. No, Neville. You give him the Neville treatment, he's on board, you secure a relationship with an investor based in the Middle East... What's happening in Bram Neville?
But do you know something? All the things that we've done since I finished playing football, I've never gone out to target people. I don't beg people for anything. I don't ask people for anything. So, Peter, I was actually over in Abu Dhabi doing something for United.
Explain who Peter
Lim. So Peter's Peter invested into hotel football with us, into Stock Exchange, into Salford. And... I was doing a Manchester United soccer school in Abu Dhabi for the club, and I just, you know, it was my first year out of football. And the person who was managing the soccer school over there said to me, "Oh, I've got a really interesting guy that is coming over tomorrow. He loves Manchester United, he loves football. Have breakfast with us." So I went and had breakfast with them, and he said, "Oh, we're talking about football." And he said, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "Oh, I said, I'm doing some things in Manchester on property, I'm doing it at hotel. I'm in the media with Sky." And he, you know, I said, "Oh, just show me the hotel." And I just showed him the whole picture of the hotel.
Which hotel was this?
It was Hotel Football.
Okay.
And we hadn't even got planning permission for it yet. And he said, "Oh," he said, "you know," he said, "who's doing that with you?" And I said, "Oh, I think Scholesy, Giggsy, Butty, Phil, you know, a few of the lads are doing it with me." And he said, "Oh, do you need any more investment?" I said, "Actually, we do. We needed more investment. We were, you know, I didn't know how we were going to do it." He said, "Oh, just send me it over and I'll have a look at it." And that's how it happened.
And am I right in saying that at the time, the club would not get involved with it?
No, the club wouldn't get involved with it. The club had the opportunity to get involved with it. But that's how it happened with Peter. With Tom, I was sat in the Corinthia at Kerridge's Bar and Grill.
Tom Kerridge, not Ford.
him next, I think. Tom Kerridge, I was just sat there. I stay at the Corinthia through the fact that I've got a real good relationship in Malta, and it's Maltese owned. So I stayed down there for all my Sky appearances, and I sat in the restaurant. Tom had just opened the restaurant in London, and sat at the sort of little breakfast bar, like a high table bar. And he came out and started speaking to me, and the room's very much like the Stock Exchange. And we didn't have a chef at the time. I DM'd him after the chat. I said, "Look, would you like to come and have a look at a restaurant, you know, in Manchester? You know, no problem if you don't." Anyway, he came up, absolutely loved it. And, you know, it was not a case of sort of me influencing him. I just said, "Come up and have a look at it." So I think that things happen for a reason. I'm quite instinctive as well. But I have to really like something to do it, be passionate about it. I try to, wherever I go in the world, I always try and eat in really good restaurant if I can, just to sort of experience different foods and everything. I genuinely really feel proud about the Bull and Bear in Manchester. I think it's an outstanding restaurant, not just because of the food and the service and the team, the design, that just the fact that it's feels like you're in another world. It feels like you're not in Manchester, where we live, it feels like you can escape. It's somewhere different.
I think the reason that the restaurant is a success in Manchester is because it's in a building that you're associated with. And I don't mean that because I want a free meal. I mean that because actually I think you've done a phenomenal job with it. I want to know what else you've got on the drawing. What else
is... But Liz, we've had bad experiences with restaurants and F&B in Manchester as well. This is the first time where really it's been successful. I want to say that. And that's because we've, to be fair, brought Tom in. We were struggling with F&B. Honestly, what the team... we built.
Well, it reflects the brand, yeah, which is where I'm back to brand. Tom Kerridge reflects your brand. Mahiki, whatever it was that opened, did not reflect your brand.
No, that was a big mistake. But that's, again, that...
It was a good night, though, the opening night.
It was a good night. Do you know what happened with that? So you open it... I mean, footballer opens a nightclub. I mean, Gary Neville opens a nightclub. I mean, seriously. So, do you know that happened? I was looking... I wanted an office that was open plan that was a coffee shop, which is we're in this building now. I don't want anybody to ever come to work with me and be stuck at a desk. It's an offence. It's actually, to be fair, it's akin to bullying for me. To stick people at a desk and say, you sit there every day, is just wrong. You have to give people an environment where they're relaxed. We had that at United. People used to move around the changing room. You could go in the lounge. You know, I want people to feel free when they're working and have that spirit about them and that enjoyment that they look forward to coming in every single day. So we basically, now our office here is almost like it's more of a coffee shop or a bar than it is, and a lounge than it is more of an office. Yeah, you can sit at a desk if you want, but generally you can sit on a settee, you can sit on a chair, you can sit at like a kitchen top. It's got to feel like you're at home and you're relaxed and you feel comfortable. And so for me, I was looking at an office next to Mahiki, and two guys walked out of the basement and they were obviously United fans. They said, oh, come in and have a look at this. And they said, we're selling it. We've got the lease up. And I'd just been a week before been in London, and someone had mentioned to me that Mahiki were looking to come to Manchester. So my little brain started ticking and thinking, here we go. This is like almost like the perfect storm. Lads are selling a nightclub, 5 o'clock license. I know Mahiki coming to Manchester. It's a marriage made in heaven. It didn't work. I mean, it was absolute shambles.
But you know, you learn by your mistakes.
You learn a lot.
Don't you?
I learned a lot. I don't make instinctive decisions anymore. So for instance, things like that instinctive. I like instinct, but that was just completely, you've got to know what you're good at and what you're not good at. And Valencia taught me that a lot. Hi, this is Gary Neville. You are listening to The Events That Made Me with Liz Taylor.
Tell me about Valencia. You're a proud guy. You know, you don't take knockbacks well. You don't.
I do take knockbacks well.
You don't?
I do.
Well, I don't think you do.
You don't know me.
Gary Neville! I know you well enough. I really don't want to spend the next 10 minutes arguing with you, but I am telling you, I don't think you take knockbacks well.
Give me an experience. I'm always willing to. I always like to learn. Tell me an experience of where you don't think I've taken a knockback well.
I don't say it in a derogatory way or a negative way, but
example.
I think that you are a very proud. You don't. You have to succeed. No failure in you. You have to succeed. And if you do fail, you take it on board as a learning curve to your next step to succeed.
But you have to evidence. If you believe I haven't taken a knockback well, then you have to evidence that. A knockback is many different things. I'm really into this type of stuff because, to be fair, when I was 24, I had a really bad experience in football. And for United fans who are listening or football fans who may remember, I give two nightmare goals away with passbacks against Vasco da Gama. Put in Gary Neville, Brazil World Championships, Vasco da Gama. I played Edmundo and Romario in. We lost the tournament. We lost the competition. And I went under. I went under for 8 months. Completely under. Lost my confidence. Doubted myself. Absolute shambles. I needed to go and see a psychologist at the time to come out of it. But since that point, I call it my mistake management or my recovery from major events that go against me. I think it's really good. Because I put a lot of work in around that time. So for instance, if my dad dies, which is a big event in my life, I didn't break stride because I always imagined that my dad was going to die. I knew it was going to come and I hated it. I still hate it to this day and I miss him like mad. But I almost come to terms with the fact that the way he lived his life, I knew I was going to lose him early. Or whether it be, say, for instance, Valencia. The minute I left Valencia, I was back on Sky within 3 months and no one would have known that I'd been a failed manager in Valencia. because I genuinely am able to compartmentalize things that I've done wrong and the things that happen bad to me and move on straight away. And that was the work that I did sort of 10, 15 years ago after Vasco da Gama, which was an absolute nightmare. You know, Scholesy always texts me Fiasco da Gama because that was the headline the next day. And, you know, it was my picture there with my head on my hands. And I felt like the whole world was looking at me. It was a World Club Championships. It was the first ever tournament in Brazil on a World Club Championships. And I'd cost us the whole tournament. So for me, I do really feel it's important to be able to handle the ups and downs of life. And that's that. My what would be reaction to adversity, I think it's been pretty good. Do I like it? No. But I move on from it really quickly. So when you say to me that I don't handle, you know, I'd want to know where that moment was, because if I didn't handle something well, I'd want to know, well, why I didn't handle it well, or because
maybe I misunderstood you after all these years. Maybe, but I am.
Did you just say you got something wrong? No, but people imagine that you don't handle things that go against you well. You know, losing St. Michael's, for instance. St. Michael's was a nightmare. We had 5,000 objections, the two big black towers that we put in for permission that got turned down.
Just tell the listener about St. Michael's.
Right? Well, St. Michael's, we've been doing now for 12 years. We've had a global recession. We were then amassing the land for a few years. We then had the big black towers that we put in that was just a farce because we just got 5,000 objections. And I basically was still in my post-Manchester United mode pre-Valencia, where I thought I could get everything through that I wanted in life. But you've got to bring people on the journey with you. And you learn all the time that basically things like this are not just about what you think's right. You have to make sure that everybody else in the city thinks it's right. And I learned a lot from that. But we corrected it straight away. We recovered from it straight away. We went back to Historic England. We started to liaise with them. They were a big part of us not having our permission for the two towers. And we went back with them to work with them. So I think where I've had, you know, setbacks in respect of things like that, we've always responded in a way which think, right, okay, we caught that up. We got that wrong. One thing, to be fair, I never allow it. At United, it comes from United. Never blame anybody else when something goes wrong. You have to blame yourself, particularly if you're someone like myself who's there, you know, say, for instance, running, you know, owns a hotel or owns St. Michael's or whatever it might be. You can't just then say, well, oh, you can't blame other people. You can't.
And what is St. Michael's going to be?
It's going to be a mixed-use development, the centre of Manchester, that we've now obviously got.
Retail, is it going to be? Restaurants?
Restaurants, commercial office building, residential and hotel. And it's something I've been on now for 13 years. We will never give up on it. We're persistent as hell. I'm hoping we can get somewhere in the next couple of months and we can announce something, because we're working hard on it at this moment in time. The team have been working hard on it for years. We'll never give up on it because it's too important to us.
And can I ask you what the investment is in this project?
To date, it's a lot. We've put a lot of our own money into it.
So you must feel confident that it's going to work.
No, it's not about being confident, because we've had a global pandemic, a global recession, a major Historic England challenge against us. We've had a judicial review challenge. There's been that many events that have stepped in the way of St. Michael's, some of which have been out of our control, that I'm never confident on this project, as in it's definitely going to happen. I won't feel confident in this project until it's built, done, and it's up there and it's happened. I can't do it because of what's happened in the last 12, 13 years.
And when that's done, will there be another brand, Neville?
No, because I think St. Michael's will be it's a landmark scheme for Manchester. I know a lot of people say that, but it truly will be. I feel less project-led. I feel like the university needs to be a big success. The football club needs to be a big success. St. Michael's needs to be delivered. We need to ensure that the Stock Exchange Hotel football continue to be its highest class that it can be in 4- and 5-star markets. And then I feel like in 4 or 5 years, hopefully, that's how I feel. I always said 50 would be the sort of point in time whereby I'll have been 15 years out of football. If I've not learnt by then how to become, you know, someone who can be a business person, adapt to another life, then I've got to think about what I'm going to do. But I feel at this moment in time, it's all there to play for. Salford are in League Two. The university's in its second year, second cohort students. St. Michael's, hopefully, will get a fair wind in the next few years. The hotels are open. So everything that I wanted to do is being done, and we're in the process of delivering it. I now have to complete it. Just to look back at a 15-year piece of work where I can say, right, broadcasting and media, coaching, I tried it, didn't quite work out. The business side, I've got to deliver on it. If I don't deliver on these businesses in the next 3 or 4 years, then the last 15 years won't count for anything. So I feel like I'm in the finishing straight, if you like, of a race, because I think 50 is the point whereby I need to then think about what I'm going to do for that next 15 years.
And how old are you?
I'm 45.
I'm more concerned about your 50th birthday.
I'm sure you are.
So you've
got... If I've done well, Liz, I'll be able to use you.
Yeah. Gary, so I'm going to end with this. You are a particularly honest, loyal operator.
Who told and you that? Where's the evidence of that?
This was on Wikipedia. I'll read it again, just in case you didn't digest it. This is serious now. I'm trying to bring this to a close seriously, so people think that this is not a Morecambe and Wise sketch, and this is a proper, you know, brand values business thing, okay? Oh, yeah. You're a particularly honest, loyal operator, and you respond to the same. It takes a while to gain your trust. You're very opinionated, but once in there, there is no one more principled than Gary Neville. Equally, you don't do second chances. If you could share one piece of advice with someone emulating your success, whether that be behind a ball or behind a desk, what would that one piece of advice be?
Get up every single day, work as hard as you possibly can, and don't give up.
Well, it's worked for you, and I want to thank you very, very much for sharing this last half hour or so with me. I'm just excited to see what happens with Brand Neville.
Oh, I'm excited to see how many numbers you get on your podcast. You get money out of this?
No, I don't get any money out of it, but here you go. I'll take coins.
This is like a PS. Is this part of the outtakes? Are we still going here?
No, we can still go. We can edit whatever we want. But this I'm not editing this at all. No, I don't get paid. Do you get paid?
What, for this?
Yes.
No, not at all, Liz.
No, but let me just explain to you. This could be another, you know, one of those life-changing moments. One of those events that made you. My podcast.
We said we were going to bring Lionel Richie to the Stock Exchange, didn't we?
Yeah, have you called him?
Not yet. He said hello.
What about... what about Bex? Get Bex up here.
He can't sing.
It doesn't matter. He can mime. I can get fortunes for him. There's loads we're going to do. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do...
building.
Yeah, in your building. We're going to do On the Sofa with Gary Neville and David Beckham and Paul Scholes. Tom Kerridge can be present and do the food.
Oh, that he'll be delighted to hear that.
Yeah, he will. And
Are you nice?
Listen to me. Yeah, I'm very nice.
Look at you drop your voice then.
I am. We're going to do this now, and we're going to give the money to charity, right? I just need the class of 92 on the sofa. We're going to have a chat. We're going to have a Tom Kerridge meal. And on that note, on that note, Gary Neville, thank you and good night.
Thank you.
There wasn't a lot that I took from my interview with Gary that I didn't already know, because he is a particularly honourable, loyal, successful, driven guy. And I have the utmost respect for him. But what I did enjoy was hearing a little bit about the football and the journey that he's just embarked on, which is going to allow him to achieve more goals than he already has. Please listen to the bonus air extension that goes along with this episode. I'll share with you how goals are really useful in business. And don't forget, if you're enjoying the events that made me, and you better be, share it with a friend and rate, review, or subscribe wherever you're listening. To find out more about how you and I can work together, look for @LizTaylorConsultancy on social media, or go to my website, which is liz-taylor-consulting.co.uk. Join me again on the 27th of January, where I have another guest for you. an international artist and sculptor who actually is the force behind a very famous chef.
Tom said he'd kind of heard on the grapes about them, and we thought, okay, well, we can't afford it, but we can't afford not to do it either. And we both had that little look in our eye, and we kind of went, come on then, let's jump. So we jumped. It just went bonkers since then, really.
And if in doubt, it is the wonderful Beth Cullen Kerridge.